Welcome to the QualiTalks podcast, a show about pharma and GMP. The pharmaceutical industry is a fascinating and complex field, and it takes countless people to bring a product to the market. In this podcast, we bring you some of the industry's brightest minds who will share their wisdom with you. You will learn about various subjects such as GMP, new trends in pharma, and leadership. This episode is sponsored by Dot Compliance, the industry's first ready-to-use quality management solution powered by the Salesforce platform. Deploying a new EQMS has never been quicker or more cost-effective. And now, please welcome your host, Jan Kugel.
Welcome to the QualiTalks podcast. I'm Jan Kugel, your host and the director at Qualistry, where we provide engaging GMP online training. This is going to be a quite interesting series of podcasts as we will be talking about CMOs, and joining us will be various guests from different sizes of CMOs in different positions. And my co-host for this series will be Amar Badawi, the CEO at PharmaOffer, a platform which allows companies to find qualified suppliers for any API. And our guest today is Kurt In Albon, the Global Head of Information Quality at Lonza. So let's get to it. So welcome to the QualiTalks podcast. And today we have a special edition where my co-host Amar is joining me. So I'm Jan Kugel, the director at Qualistry. And Amar, he is the CEO at PharmaOffer. And joining us today as our guest is Kurt, who is the Head of Global Information at Lonza. And our topic today will be CMOs. And to understand what are those, what types of CMOs are there, and really, are they designed for? So, Kurt, welcome. And maybe you can say a few words about yourself.
Yeah, with a pleasure. Thank you, Jan, for having me. Thank you, Amar. My name is Kurt In Albon. I've been in the industry for 25 plus years now. I have to say that I've been in one company for 25 plus years, one CMO, but in very different roles. My background is in information science or IT, and I have an additional education in pharmaceutical validation. At the company where I work at Lonza, which is one of the largest CMOs in the world, I had a team of 14 people who take care of information quality. So we are reporting into the quality organization, not into IT or OT. And we are busy with qualification validation of computerized systems, making sure that the data quality, data integrity is given, and so on. So it's a very wide-ranging remit and a lot of fun to work in that area.
Can you explain a bit more about what types of products can Lonza produce in their CMO?
As a CMO, we are specializing in the biopharmaceutical area, so mammalian and microbial manufacturing. But we also have offerings in the area of cell and gene therapy, where one of our manufacturing sites is in the United States. Another one is in the Netherlands. And it's a quickly growing business, a quickly growing part of Lonza as well. You may have seen in the news that we are manufacturing for one of our customers COVID-19 vaccine. This is the first time that Lonza manufactures a vaccine. So this was an entry into a new type of business. But we also manufacture that as the CMO for our customer.
Okay. Can you say that basically all CMOs are the same, or can you put them in different types of CMOs?
I would say in a way they're all the same by their companies you want to outsource to. And then there are the differences. There are CMOs which offer you basically just the API in a drum, for example, or in a bulk container. And then there are CMOs which help you, for example, with the final fill. They go a couple of steps further. And then there are CMOs, CDMOs, then development and manufacturing organizations, who also help you with the development of the manufacturing process, with the scale-up. A lot of CMOs have customers which are very small companies, startup companies, that don't have their own manufacturing capacity, that don't have the experience, that don't have the regulatory fitness, if you will, but that are just, in air quotes, just because they make the invention, but that are companies that have a lab, a development lab, with a couple of very bright people who develop a new molecule and say, okay, there's promise in this. let's take this to the clinic. And then they find a CDMO that can manufacture a small amount of the material for clinical use, which is slightly different than commercial manufacturing in terms of regulations. And then the really strong CDMOs, they take the customer then to the next step. So small scale, mid-scale, large scale, if successful, and then onto commercial manufacturing throughout, either as a primary or secondary supplier of the API of the drug.
Yes, I understand. So basically, in the entire supply chain, there are different CMOs for different steps of the development of product.
That's correct. But there are also CDMOs that cover a larger area of the supply chain. Let's say in the best of all possible worlds, a CDMO, you would give them the molecule and they give you the pill packaged, right? So that you can focus purely on the science, on the development of the drug, and have somebody else do all the tedious stuff.
So you said that, for example, many startups who are developing a new medicine. I'm quite curious, how does that process work? Because I imagine there are several very smart people working in a lab, and they have to find the right CMO. But I can imagine that they are not very experienced in that part of developing the drug. Where do you start finding the right CMO?
That's an interesting question, actually. I think that many times the startup is not the company that finds the CDMO, but it's the investor who is experienced with investing into small, let's say, pharmaceutical ventures. The venture capital company may pick the CDMO for the startup. They may tell them, look, you best go to this CDMO, they have got the, for this type of product, the best offer. These guys have their analysts, they have their microbiologists, chemists, PhDs working for them as well. And this goes back to what you said earlier, Amar. A lot of people don't know a lot about CDMOs. Why? Because their names are not out there in public. Their names are behind the curtain. They manufacture the stuff, but there's not a single product from our company. Or not a lot, there are a couple where we make something that has our logo on it. But from the APIs, for example, that we manufacture, there's not a single one that has the Lonza logo stamped to it. So how would people know these companies exist? It's market research mostly that they need to do. And then they also talk to these companies, and it comes down to offering and cost and speed to market, which is a very critical measure by any standard.
So what is the history of the CMOs, CDMOs? So were they there forever? Or at some point, somebody realized, okay, there is here a market, because the smaller companies at the startups or the university, they need somebody who is not a pharma company with innovative drugs, but they don't want to share the patents. And then they said, okay, we need someone who is maybe short-term partner or long-term partner who is not the owner of the patent. So what was the idea behind the CMOs, and how long do they exist, if you have this information?
I don't know who was the first CMO or how long they've really been in existence. But what I think happened was that if you look at the large pharma companies in the world, the Pfizers, the Novartis, the Roches of this world, if you look at them and you look at the number of drugs that they have on the market, if you imagine that you need manufacturing capacity for each of these drugs, and because the drugs are so different, you have everything. You have from microbiological manufacturing, chemical manufacturing. You have today modern drugs such as antibody drug conjugates, where you need both. You need a chemical payload and you need an antibody that carries it to the tumor cell, for example. If you need such complex manufacturing plants as a pharmaceutical company, you invest a lot of the money into those manufacturing plants that may already exist. So I think the first CDMOs, the first successful CDMOs, were the ones who said, okay, I'm taking a risk. I'm investing in building this multi-purpose chemical plant, for example. Okay, I can manufacture these types of compounds in it, and I may have to clean or change the plant slightly, but overall, it's a multi-purpose plant. And back in the, I would say, 1995, maybe 1990, was when our company started building what was called a so-called fine chemistry complex. And that was, for example, our move from bulk chemicals for agriculture, for example, fertilizer and stuff like that, into the more refined area of fine chemicals and APIs. And those were and are still, that plant is still in operation, multi-purpose plants. And they can manufacture a large range of chemical compounds. So when a customer of ours has a certain chemical compound that fits into this category, snap, that's what they do, right? They talk to us and we tell them what we need to do to modify our manufacturing plant to accommodate that. I think that's how a lot of these CMOs, CDMOs came to be. There's one exception or one example where a large parent company realized there's money to be had in microbiological drugs and then just invested a huge amount of money to set up a new brand spanking new biopharma company under their name.
So you mentioned multipurpose facilities, right? So how more complex would you say that the CMOs, CDMOs are in comparison with the standard innovative or generic pharma organizations?
If you look at it, the complexity in the manufacture of a chemical or microbiological API, the complexity is in the bulk, in the scale-up, in the different studies on how do you have to scale your equipment to get the same quality attributes. What are the critical process parameters? How are they changing as you scale up? This is something that the pharma company does not necessarily have to think about when they outsource to a CDMO. The complexity on their side is really in R&D, okay? The complexity is in the science of screening the compounds, of actually finding compounds that might be candidates for drugs, of filtering out the ones that are not. The application of bioinformatics, for example, is something that is extremely important for these guys in their R&D lab. The complexity of manufacturing, mid-scale, large-scale, of the CDMO, and also of matching that to the supply chain that is coming in sideways with all the raw materials that we need and so on. That's really where we are complex. So I don't know if there's a degree whether you can say this one is more complex than the other one, but I believe that really a lot of the science really happens with the CDMO.
I can imagine that if you're working together with someone who is developing a drug and you come at that stage that you really start to producing the end product, is it part of being a CMO that after a while, when the product is becoming so commercialized, that you're losing your customer because they will build their own plant?
That happens, but it's not the normal case. In my career, I would say I've experienced that two or three times, but it's not the norm. Usually what happens is the CDMO that receives the contract will invest quite a bit of time and money once you go to commercial manufacturing to make the manufacturing process better, leaner, to increase the yield, to reduce waste, to maybe modify a raw material so that you have a better product and so on, which is something that is lost if you switch. If you say, okay, now you've manufactured 50 batches for me, I've built up my own plant now, I'm taking it back. By that time, you may already have a drift in the manufacturing process, which worked to the advantage of the CDMO and the disadvantage of the original manufacturer. So most of the time, the customers, especially if they're happy, they stay with the CDMO and they let them manufacture the product through the patent protection and then maybe even beyond that, depending on how good the process has become over the years. I know that some of our manufacturing processes have really, really improved a lot, also because the customer gave us their trust and allowed us to continue to develop. And we then also support them in, for example, changes to the filing that may become necessary. If you make a change in the manufacturing process and you make a change in the formula or the raw materials, critical process parameters, critical quality attributes, you have to change the filing. So we can also support our customers with that. And a lot of CDMOs do that.
If you were developing a product and you had to find a CMO to partner up with, what questions would you ask to that CMO to find out whether there's a good fit and that they are capable to produce your product?
So the first thing that I would do is check the history of the CDMO or CMO. I would pay a visit to the FDA website and check them out for warning letters, maybe get an impression on their quality culture. Many times what customers or small or also the large pharma companies do when they look for a CDMO is they go and they do an audit, like due diligence almost. And the questions that they then ask are about the track record, quality track record. Can you manufacture this amount of product in that amount of time? Or how much do you think you can supply us with? And one question I think that I would ask is how quickly can you get me to the market? And I think in today's supply chain, the way that the market has developed into this partnership between the pharma company and the CMO, This is one of the most critical things. If you imagine years ago, people used to say the development of a drug takes between, 7 to 12 years. And then you have only a couple of years where you can sell it under patent protection, and then it goes generic. So every month that you squeezed out on your way to the market was a potentially considerable financial advantage. I think this has become one of the central questions that pharma companies ask CMOs today: how quickly to get to the market. And the CMOs invest a lot of thinking and creative ideas into making that better. In the heads of people, you still see these numbers like 15 years until a new drug comes out. Look what happened during the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. There was a science in place that nobody outside of the scientific community had really talked about. You've read about it in the papers. I guess the researchers were familiar with mRNA. And then in less than a year, we go to commercial production of a complex molecule. Some of the speed that was achieved there was thanks to the regulators, because they started doing parallel reviews instead of sequential. That's a great thing. But also one part of the speed, and a big part of the speed, was the CDMOs actually applying those technologies and applying that science to bring a drug to the market faster than it used to be. And people were incredulous. People say, oh, it's impossible. I mean, look at HIV, 35 years and still no vaccine in sight. And this is a completely new virus. No, first of all, it's not. And second, there were really a lot of smart people at the CMOs really thinking about how do we get that stuff out as quickly as we can in the appropriate quality with all the safety and patient protection considered. A CMO or a pharma company cannot afford to take shortcuts on that. So I think the speed to the market, the time to the market would be the first question that I would ask.
Our customers set high expectations for their teams and need to be sure they perform to these expectations. Many companies struggle to find time to train their employees and often delegate this responsibility to a department that has not got the expertise to master the subject matter. As a result, they burden their team with the conventional training material, which can be so dull that they shut down. We invest time into helping our customers become GMP compliant in a fast and efficient manner to make sure their teams perform to the highest standards. We specialize in creating engaging training that will make your employees confident and motivated in using their new learned skills at the workplace. Visit us at www.qualistery.com or contact us at service@qualistery.com for more information.
So to build upon Amar's question, right, how to choose the right CMO also for the quality. So we've seen a while back that, as you mentioned, so the COVID vaccines came out really quickly, and then also big pharmas like Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, they needed other partners, other CMOs to help them with the production, right? And then we seen issues like issues with packaging. Then we heard a while back about a huge recall of the Johnson & Johnson in the USA because there were some issues in the CMO's manufacturing facilities. And we see that even huge companies who partner sometimes maybe don't do the right due diligence, because you would think, okay, Johnson & Johnson probably would really be on top of it, but they dropped the ball here, right? So what really should even big companies or such companies look at to make sure that the CMOs are really not there? You know, when there is a drug like COVID, there may be companies that will jump on the opportunity to say, oh, we will bring you there like much quicker than the other guys. But that may be a bit dangerous, right? So you need to really consider the option and see that they really can do it in the most safe way, right? So what would be your questions? How would you do it if you were them?
The specific case that you mentioned with the CMO that was manufacturing for the two big pharma companies, AstraZeneca and Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, not Pfizer. There were a lot of things that went wrong there in sequence, I think. The manufacturing facility had a not too stellar quality track record or regulatory track record. I believe there were citations by authorities before this happened. I cannot guess at what went wrong, but my personal opinion is that, like in an airplane crash, it's not one single cause, but a whole chain of events that is needed to make accidents like that one happen. And I don't think people were trying to take shortcuts, but if you work in the pharmaceutical industry and a crisis like this pandemic happens, you feel the pressure like you've never felt it before. And I can attest to that. I've been in it 25 years and I've never seen anything like this. And then the pressure is truly huge. Now, under pressure, things may break. Okay. Things that would normally, in a normal setting, work perfectly fine. Right. So my assumption is that something like that must have happened there. I would put it down to the pressure. I mean, the pressure is, in this case, and this is maybe a little bit silly, political, the pressure comes from the media as well. And you feel it as a pharmaceutical manufacturer. When you commit yourself and you say, okay, we're getting into helping the world recover from this incredible situation, spotlights are on you immediately and your every move is observed. Why did this happen? I don't know. I can't tell. Something broke under pressure. That's my best guess.
And do you think that after this corona time, that there is a new standard for how quick you get new products to the market?
All right. Let's say that I think the pandemic has forced manufacturers, CMOs, pharma companies, and regulators to rethink procedures. And in a way, I think that's good. I hope we don't overdo it. But in any case, for example, I think that in the future, rolling submissions for life-saving drugs with a very long clinical phase, rolling submissions will become more common. During the pandemic, it was the first time that I saw a rolling submission. And I saw how it worked when the first companies like Pfizer and Moderna started submitting data. I remember how downcast I felt when I read the clinical study report on the internet for the Moderna vaccine and for the Pfizer vaccine. It said the clinical study phase 3 is going to take until October 2022. And I thought, oh my God, it's going to take that long until we have a vaccine, right? And then they started about emergency authorizations and rolling submissions. Now, the emergency authorization cuts through the red tape. That's okay, but it just requires twice the diligence. And the rolling submission is really, okay, here's a chunk of data. You start analyzing while we continue working. Okay. And I think that's a very smart way of doing it. And I think we'll see more of that. That is one thing that I believe will probably change. Also, depending on the criticality of the drug. I mean, there have been in the past, there have been drugs which with the regulators got fast track. They were assigned to the fast track, so to speak. And then they got through faster because they addressed an orphan need or something like that. And other drugs which where you say, okay, the 5,000th painkiller against a headache, we'll take our time with that because there's already a lot of good stuff on the market, so we don't really need to hurry, and that'll go the normal way.
I also have another question, but more in general. What is the business model of a CMO? I mean, you're producing products, so I can imagine that you have a price per product. But if there is, I mean, in the first stage, you can also give a price per hour or for the investigation stage. How in general does different types of CMOs make money?
Good question. I ask myself that sometimes. Seriously, I think that there are very different models. There's the model where you charge per batch, where you charge per weight unit, or where you charge for the use of a manufacturing suite, right? So, and especially in the, let's say, early 2000s to 2010 was when CDMOs across the globe went away from the, I invest into a risky multipurpose plant or into a risky large-scale biopharmaceutical manufacturing plant with a 20,000-liter reactor that may stay empty for 5 years. They said, no, we'll only build the manufacturing plant when we have the customer. So we'll tell the customer, we're good at building plants. And while we're at it, you don't mind if we build two of them and we rent one of them to you for the next 5 to 10 years or whatever, or we manufacture a certain number of batches for you. That depends very heavily on the contract. It also depends on the API. If you manufacture something like paracetamol or ibuprofen, you charge by the ton. If you manufacture something like pharmaceutical peptide, like some companies in Belgium are doing, who are specialized on peptides, you charge per gram or per batch, because there you may have a batch of 800 grams, which costs 5 million. I think it depends heavily on what you make, also on the novelty of the product. Okay, so if it's something you've never manufactured before and the customer is willing to develop together with you the large-scale manufacturing process, You may be able to charge for those development costs as well. Okay. So you recoup your costs and you say, okay, I'll put a premium on that for myself for delivering the process to them in addition to the product. Also, the quality services are for some CDMOs, the submission handling. There are companies which will handle the entire regulatory submission process for a startup, for example. And there are companies who don't do that. I say, okay, for regulatory, go to someone else. That's not in our expertise. What a big customer is mostly looking for, or is often, not mostly, but often looking for, is how big is the package that the CDMO can give me? How much do I have to do myself? And how much can I really outsource? And my wife calls this the 360-degree zero-sorrow model. In German, it's Sorglos, the zero-worries package.
Are there also such corporations where you take some percentage, or you're developing, you're taking some percentage of the patent, or you're doing it in a corporation development?
In this case, I think it would depend heavily. It was the CMO as a CRO, maybe as a contract research organization, involved with the discovery of the product, right, of the molecule. There, that may be the case, but otherwise I wouldn't be aware of that.
Right. Because it's interesting, because there are a lot of big companies, you know, like Pfizer, right, or Teva Pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. They usually, they're not CMOs, but they or purchase other companies in order to grow, or they go into cooperation and during the research stage, right? And I would think, mm-hmm. Okay, CMOs have such a great capacity to build the plants and adjust themselves to different products that it would also make sense to make some agreements during the mm-hmm. development phase already to go to scale.
It might make sense, but I think that the CMOs are probably also being a little bit careful there, because let's say a CMO suddenly has the idea, you know what, we want a drug with our logo, and we buy this little startup now, they've got a promising molecule, and we'll help them take it to the markets, put our logo on it, buy that little company. And then you have to realize you just dived into a shark tank. You just dived in to play with the big boys. And the big boys are the Pfizers, the Novartises, the Tevas, the Roches of this world. And these guys have a head start on everything R&D. Okay. So I think there may be CMOs who dream of being a full-fledged pharma company like Pfizer, Roche, or Novartis. But most of them probably say, you know what, we're good at what we're doing. Let's get better at what we're doing, but let's stick with it.
Right. Makes sense. Sometimes it's better also to have less offering, but be the best in what you offer.
Exactly. That is also something that a CMO should always write on their flag. We want to give you the best quality, the best patient safety, and the best data integrity.
So you said that when customers come to you, they usually stay with you like forever, hopefully, right? So this is a hope they bring. So those are research organizations. They make a patent, they bring to you the drug, and they run with you as their main manufacturer and they put their logo on it. So does it mean that you have a capacity? So it means that you not always accepting new clients? Does it mean that you have a certain capacity for clients because of issues with the place that you have, or then you're ready to build new facilities for them depending on how much money they bring?
That is a case-by-case thing, I believe. You can always be too successful for your own good. If we're up to capacity, it may happen that we have to say no to someone, okay? It depends also. I mean, the first answer is, of course, always let's work together. Let's see what we can do. And if the CMO cannot deliver immediately, maybe there's a way of shifting temporarily to another one and then back or something like that to bridge the gap. There are different models, there are different ways. And of course, in the most successful joint ventures with a pharma company, the CMO will say, okay, yes, we stand to benefit from this partnership so much that we say, yep, we're willing to invest into a specific manufacturing facility for you. And I mean, this has been in the press, so I can talk about that. Lonza is building a second bit of capacity for the Moderna vaccines, right? So we're doubling capacity there because the customer says, can you do it? And we say, yes, we're willing to do it. There's clearly a need on the market. It happens, yeah.
When should a company, a small company, a pharma company, or a research organization should not go to CMOs? When should they decide to do it all by themselves?
Never. I don't, to be frank, I don't have an answer to that question. There's when would they not go? You have to imagine the development or the discovery of the molecule is already a very cost-intensive process. And you're probably, as a small startup, you're probably dependent on a venture capital company. Okay, and that venture capital company dictates everything you do. They got a guy in your offices who pays attention how much paper you use and how much coffee you drink. So while you're in that situation, I think actually going to the venture capital company and saying, look, you know what, we need 150 million more so we can build our own manufacturing facility. The venture capital company will probably tell you, you know what, you can get it for 70 million at Lonza, Catalent, Samsung Biologics, whatnot, right? Any of the big CDMOs. So why don't we go there? I think that would be a rare occasion that really the seedling starts from zero and then grows into a full-blown tree. Very rare, I think.
Right. So most of the small startups that we have are the ones who then deciding to try to be independent because they don't want to give up the control of the manufacturing. But from your perspective, it's better for them as researchers or developers to stay where they're best, like continue developing new drugs and leave us the manufacturing then?
It probably is very good advice, let's say. Stick with what you're good at. Get better at it, of course, always. Improve. Get leaner, meaner, faster. Get new ideas. Develop your product pipeline. I think one thing that happens is the small pharmaceutical organization that is mainly concerned with discovery and clinical then is successful with a couple of drugs in their portfolio, in their pipeline, and then starts thinking about, why don't I acquire a manufacturing facility from an established CMO or other pharma company that maybe wants to get rid of it and put my drug in there? That could be a situation where it grows like into its own organization and they manufacture their own drug. What happens then is oftentimes when they are very successful, they awaken the interest of the big sharks. And then they get swallowed. That has happened in the past as well.
It's quite known that a large part of the development projects fail, you know, during the R&D stage.
That's right.
How is it from the moment that a CMO got involved? Is there still a part that fail even during the production stage?
Yes, you have to think that, for example, a lot of drugs that make it to the CDMO are still in clinical phase, 2, 3 maybe. And it has happened that products that were manufactured 2, 3 batches for a clinical phase 3 study, that they failed in phase 3, and then the product is gone. Or that even a product that goes to commercial manufacturing is not successful enough because there's a competitor product on the market that just sells better for whatever reason. I don't know, maybe it's cheaper, maybe it has less side effects, or maybe it's better marketing. All of these things happen. Right. So, yes, there are failures at that stage as well, but thankfully, they're few and far between.
What do you think the future of the CDMO will look like? Let's say in about 20 years, will there things really change? Or do you think in general, things will stay the same?
Let me get my crystal ball from behind. That's a very good question, actually. I think that the trend to outsourcing, and essentially, that's what you do. When you go to a CMO, you outsource, is strong, just like it is strong in IT, just like it is strong in other areas. There are companies that outsource their whole HR. So you have today service suppliers like the classical ones, IBM, KPMG, the big ones, right, who provide you with all these types of services, and these services are integrated. Now, that's not just a bit of storage somewhere anymore, but it's a bit of storage and the whole process that surrounds it, and we're giving that to you. That is a strong trend right now. I don't think it's going to abate anytime soon. And I think the same is true for the outsourcing trend in the pharma industry, especially as long-time partnerships form. Again, as this has been in the press, I can talk about it, the contract between Moderna and Lonza. That's a 10-year contract. Right. And as such long-term contracts evolve, I think the companies will grow together a bit more, both business-wise and technically. Interfaces are going to build up. More joint ventures are going to happen. Mergers and acquisitions, I don't want to get into that. That's a business. First of all, I don't understand it. And secondly, I sometimes wish I would even know less about it because it's not always clear to me how that happens. But I think these mega mergers may become less. simply because the market can accommodate the competitors as they are in the future at one point, right? I'm not saying it's going to stop or anything. It's still going to continue, but I think it'll become a little bit less because companies that are a bit smaller are more agile and they can react faster. We live in a world today where things can change literally from today to tomorrow. COVID is, again, a prime example. This turned the whole world upside down in a very short amount of time. In a world where such things happen, in a world where such things happen at such a rate, I believe that companies need to remain agile. And as a pharma company, you are agile if you just pick your best CDMO for the best product that you make. The big pharma companies seldom work with only one CMO, right? They have multiple sources. They're also, depending on the market, they are also obliged to have multiple sources because if you supply a life-saving drug to the market, you need to be able to have several sources because if one source goes down, you still need to supply the market. So I think CDMOs, CMOs, CROs, CDROs, they are here to stay and it'll become a bit stronger.
I agree with you. Yeah, it looks like that everything goes to outsourcing right now. And do you feel that there is a danger that the Chinese or even Indian CMO market will take over because of competitive prices? Do you think they're almost getting there in terms of quality? Or do you think the American, the European ones are still much further away?
Again, a good question. I think that 15, 20 years ago, it was like the complex products get manufactured in Europe, in the United States, in the West, technically, and the bulk products get shifted to the East, where labor is cheap, with the growing middle class in countries like China and India. This is going to change. Salaries are going to go up. People are going to acquire more wealth. Labor is going to become more expensive. So why would you shift then the cheap product over there if it still costs as much to manufacture it? I think that we can learn from the Chinese very much. And one thing that we can learn is that they take the long view. Westerners have the tendency of taking a short-time view. Everything has to happen now, and it has to happen fast. And it is a trend that is only valid for a short time, and then we already switch to the next one. The Chinese take their time. And I think that is something that we need to maybe take a step back. You realize that, for example, there is not a single paracetamol manufacturing plant in Europe, in the United States anymore. I think the last one that closed down was a plant in France a couple of years ago. All the paracetamol that we consume on the planet is manufactured either in India or in China. CDMOs will find big markets there because there too, pharma companies are growing. We may not know them here by name, but if you go to India, for example, there's a couple of very well-known names. Dr. Reddy's, Sun Pharmaceuticals, formerly Ranbaxy, one of the biggest generics manufacturers in the world. And when people heard they were an Indian company, they went like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that. So there are markets there for the CDMOs as well.
Is there anything, Kerr, that you would like to add about CMOs that we didn't discuss, but you feel it's really important to mention?
So as I said, I've worked for this organization for 25 years. And in the beginning, I didn't think this was so important. I was young and had yet a lot to learn about the industry and life in general. But I thought that it's okay if nobody knows your company. You are the one behind the scenes. You do nice stuff and you don't have to talk about it. You don't have to tell everyone about it. And at the time, Lonza had a marketing slogan. It was a picture of a lot of products, well-known products. And it said, at the top, it said, Lonza shadowed by household names. Right. So basically, all these products contain something that we made, vitamin B3, niacin, certain other feed or food ingredients, plastic precursors, fertilizer, stuff like that. And nowhere was there a Lonza logo on it. Right. And I think today, with the spotlight that we have received as a CMO in the past year, I think it's good if people understand that a drug, especially a drug, something that they take to make them feel better, to make them healthier, to save their lives sometimes, to allow them to function and work and live a full and happy life, that not all of that comes out of one single hand, but there are literally thousands of people from different organizations, from different companies, including these strange CMOs that nobody knows what they are, including these people, are involved in making those products. Okay, it's not the name of the pharma company and the drug pops out. There's a huge world behind it. And I think it's important for me, it's a wish that people understand the complexity behind it and that there's a lot of science and not a lot of conspiracies, if you want to know the truth from my experience, behind that products that make us safer and better and healthier.
Thank you very much for summarizing those words that, yeah, pharma matters. Now we understand during the COVID how much, because I think I also read that after so many years, the reputation of pharma and went up because usually for some reason, everybody takes drugs and takes medicines, but nobody trusts pharma for some reason, right? But now it seems that the trust is coming back with this. And I hope that also companies like Lonza and other CMOs, CDMOs will get the intention that they need. So thank you very much again for joining us today. And Amar, thank you very much for co-hosting this.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the QualiTalks podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review. If you want to learn more about GMP, please visit us at www.qualistery.com. Stay compliant and see you at the next one.